Hello, this is the Abstract Podcast, the podcast that takes the new scientific literature of veterinary diagnostic imaging to you. No fluff, no stress, just an easy way to catch up with what is new while you drive, exercise, or have breakfast.
We search PubMed every week and select the studies relevant to veterinary diagnostic imaging that were added this week. You then decide if you prefer to go and read the whole manuscript later. I am Sarah.
And I am Alex. We are AI-generated hosts, but the science discussed is grounded in PubMed. So this is the week from July 5th, 2026, to July 11th, 2026. All right, Sarah, first up, we have a fascinating case report from the exotics world. This is from Koonsman at Gulf Coast Veterinary Specialists in the USA, published in the Journal of Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care. It's a case report describing a xenotransfusion, that's a transfusion between different species, in an African pygmy hedgehog.
Specifically, from a domestic cat. The one-year-old hedgehog presented with severe anemia, a PCV of 14%, and suspected uterine pathology. A modified slide crossmatch showed no agglutination, so they went ahead with the feline blood transfusion before and during an ovariohysterectomy.
And the outcome was great. The hedgehog recovered well, and its PCV was up to 44% 2 weeks later. This is a huge deal for emergency stabilization in these small mammals, where species-specific blood is, well, basically impossible to find.
It is a life-saving intervention, but it's an N of one, Alex. We have no idea about delayed hemolytic reactions or antibody formation. The authors correctly state it should only be used with extreme caution when there are no other options. A single successful case doesn't establish a protocol.
I hear you, but for a practitioner in an emergency with a dying hedgehog on the table, this report provides a potential, albeit risky, lifeline. It's a pragmatic solution in a pinch.
Sticking with single species, let's move to horses. This is a paper by Wright and colleagues from Cornell University in the USA, published in the Equine Veterinary Journal. It's a multi-institutional retrospective case series on a modified technique for repairing jaw fractures in horses.
They looked at 11 horses with mandibular or maxillary fractures, treated with what they call a modified wire-reinforced bisacryl composite interdental splint. The goal was to provide stability without damaging tooth roots, which is always the major concern with these repairs.
Well, the outcomes were reportedly favorable. The appliances stayed in place for about 9 weeks on average, and complications were minor, things like wire loosening. However, it's a retrospective series from 6 different hospitals. That means no standardization in diagnostics, surgery, or follow-up. And critically, no control group.
True, but it's tough to get a control group for trauma cases like this. The key takeaway for me is that this technique seems feasible, cost-effective, and biomechanically sound. For surgeons in the field facing a nasty jaw fracture, this paper describes a very practical and successful approach. It's a solid addition to our surgical toolbox. Let's stay with horses, and another one from the Equine Veterinary Journal. This is a case report by Thompson and colleagues from the Royal Veterinary College in the UK. It details the CT findings and surgical management of a pneumococcal sinus in a 2-year-old cob filly.
Right, a pneumococcal is an abnormal hypernumatization of the paranasal sinuses where the bony walls become thinned. This filly had progressive inspiratory stertor. Standing C-T was the key diagnostic here.
And the images were striking. It showed extensive bilateral dilation of the conchal sinuses, which were basically obliterating the nasal passages. They went in with a transnasal diode laser to create permanent fenestrations into the nasal cavity, and the filly had a complete resolution of clinical signs.
A fantastic outcome, and the CT imaging was clearly essential for diagnosis and surgical planning. But we must remember, it is a single case. It's a great how-to and a good reminder to keep this on the differential list for upper airway obstruction, but it's not more than that.
Absolutely. But for a rare condition, a well-documented case report like this is incredibly valuable. It's a perfect example of advanced imaging directly leading to a successful, novel surgical treatment.
Now to our feline friends. With a report on a rare neoplastic presentation, Keel and colleagues from the Universidade Federal do Rio Grande do Sul in Brazil have published a case report in the Journal of Comparative Pathology. The case is a primary pancreatic histiocytic sarcoma with peritoneal sarcomatosis in a 12-year-old cat.
That sounds aggressive. The cat presented with non-specific signs like anorexia and vomiting. Ultrasound found a pancreatic mass, and cytology of the abdominal fluid suggested carcinomatosis.
Exactly. But on postmortem, the histopathology and immunohistochemistry told a different story. The neoplasia was positive for vimentin and IBA1, but negative for cytokeratin, confirming a histiocytic sarcoma, not a carcinoma. The pattern of spread just mimicked a carcinomatosis.
So the imaging and initial cytology were misleading. This is a really important reminder that even classic presentations can have surprising final diagnoses. Histiocytic sarcoma isn't common in cats. And this pancreatic origin with this pattern of spread is certainly one to file away in the memory banks.
Indeed. It's a single case, but the thorough IHC workup provides a definitive and educational diagnosis. It highlights a potential pitfall in relying solely on cytology for these abdominal effusion cases.
Okay, let's talk about something we see all the time. Chronic otitis in brachycephalic dogs. This paper is by Mendez and colleagues from the San Marco Veterinary Clinic in Italy, published in Veterinary Dermatology. It's a retrospective analysis of 17 fibroepithelial polyps of the ear canal found in 14 dogs.
And the breed signal is deafening. All 14 dogs were brachycephalic, with French bulldogs being the most common. Most had a history of chronic otitis and atopic dermatitis. C-dected 15 of the 17 polyps, and video otoscopy was used for diagnosis and removal.
And the treatment was quite successful. They removed them endoscopically, and 13 of the 14 dogs had no recurrence during a follow-up period of up to 80 months. Histologically, they had a distinct fibrous core, and interestingly, 13 of the polyps contained bone.
The retrospective nature is a clear limitation. But the clinical message is strong. These oral polyps seem to be a significant issue in brachycephalic breeds with chronic ear disease.
I think the so what here is huge, Sarah. For any Frenchie with stubborn recurrent otitis, we need to be thinking about these polyps. Identification and endoscopic removal could be the key to finally resolving the issue. It's a very practical, clinically relevant paper.
All right, moving on to a Tier 2 journal now. This is a useful reference interval study. This is from Roland and colleagues at the Metropolitan Animal Specialty Hospital in the USA, published in the American Journal of Veterinary Research. The objective was to establish breed-specific reference intervals for vertebral heart size, or VHS, and vertebral left atrial size, or VLAS.
And they looked at 8 different breeds, including some common ones we struggle with, like French bulldogs, dachshunds, and greyhounds. They retrospectively reviewed thoracic radiographs from dogs with no evidence of cardiopulmonary disease, and a single cardiologist performed all the measurements, which is great for consistency.
The numbers are the key here. For example, the VHS reference interval for French bulldogs was 9.9 to 13.0 vertebrae. That is a substantially higher upper limit than the generally accepted 10.7.
I hear you on the stats, Sarah, but in the field, this is still a step forward. This is immediately useful information. How many times have we overcalled cardiomegaly in a Frenchie or a Greyhound? Having these breed-specific numbers helps us be more accurate and avoid unnecessary workups.
Well, it's a good starting point. Clinicians should be aware of these results, but remember, these are just reference intervals from one population. They aren't definitive cutoffs for disease. Still, a very useful paper.
Next, we have another interesting feline case report from Nogueira and colleagues in Brazil, published in the Brazilian Journal of Veterinary Medicine. This report describes a case of paraneoplastic hypereosinophilic syndrome associated with lymphocytic intestinal lymphoma in a 13-year-old cat.
The key finding here was the blood work. The cat had a massive leukocytosis, 81,500, which was almost entirely mature eosinophils. That's a striking number.
It sure is. Abdominal ultrasound showed lymphadenomegaly and an infiltrative pattern in the mesentery, raising suspicion for lymphoma. Intestinal biopsies confirmed alimentary lymphoma. The interesting part is what happened with treatment.
They started a chemo protocol of prednisolone and chlorambucil. After 6 months, the cat was clinically stable, the ultrasound abnormalities had resolved, and the eosinophil count had dropped from 69,000 down to 9,000.
This is a fantastic clinical pearl. It strongly supports the link between the lymphoma and the extreme eosinophilia, as a paraneoplastic syndrome. So when you see a cat with a sky-high eosinophil count, you absolutely need to have alimentary lymphoma high on your differential list and reach for that ultrasound probe.
A valid point. Though it is just one case, it certainly reinforces the association. Let's move on to an oncology case report. Adhikari and colleagues from the Central Referral Veterinary Hospital in Nepal published this in Case Reports in Veterinary Medicine. It's a report of a proximal radiosulnar osteosarcoma in a 3.5-year-old Great Dane.
Osteosarcoma is common, but the location here is quite unusual. The dog presented with forelimb lameness and swelling just distal to the elbow. Radiograph showed a mixed lytic proliferative lesion in the proximal radius and ulna.
The diagnosis was confirmed via histopathology after a forelimb amputation. The dog recovered well from surgery and had no evidence of recurrence at a 6-month follow-up, though the owner declined adjuvant chemotherapy.
This is a straightforward case report, but it serves a good purpose. It reminds us that while osteosarcoma has its classic locations, away from the elbow, towards the knee, Jared can pop up anywhere. We need to keep it on our differential list for any aggressive bone lesion, regardless of the site.
A fair point. It's a simple reminder not to get complacent with our differentials.
Okay, back to horses, this time focusing on reproduction. This is from Lima and colleagues in the Journal of Equine Veterinary Science. It's a preliminary study evaluating a phytotherapeutic or plant-based intrauterine therapy for mares with bacterial endometritis.
It was a randomized study with 20 mares. 10 received a standard uterine lavage, and 10 received the lavage plus the phytotherapeutic infusions. They assessed response using uterine culture, cytology, and ultrasonography over 10 days.
And the result was nothing. There were no significant differences between the two groups in bacterial clearance, cytologic improvement, or overall treatment response. At day 10, 50 to 60% of mares in both groups still had positive bacterial cultures.
The authors correctly identify the limitations, a small sample size, and, importantly, no positive control group, like an antimicrobial treated group. They also noted the phytotherapeutic solution had no detectable antimicrobial activity in vitro.
To me, this is a really important negative result. With growing concerns about antimicrobial resistance, people are looking for alternatives. This study suggests this particular product, at least under these conditions, is not an effective one. It's just as useful to know what times doesn't time work.
Next is a surgical case report with some interesting imaging follow-up. This is from Ryu and colleagues at the BON Animal Medical Center, published in the Journal of Veterinary Medical Science. It details the reconstruction of a chronic gastrocnemius tendon rupture in a poodle.
This wasn't a simple primary repair. The rupture was 3 weeks old, and after debridement, there was a 20-millimeter gap. They couldn't just pull the ends together, so they bridged the defect using a double layer of ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene suture tape.
And they also augmented it with a flexor digitorum lateralis transposition. The follow-up is the key part. At 2 months, ultrasonography confirmed the tendon was intact, with no signs of foreign body reaction to the suture tape.
The clinical outcome was excellent. By 3 months, the dog's plantigrade stance had resolved, and gait analysis was nearly symmetric. This paper provides a potential solution for those difficult chronic tendon ruptures with significant tissue loss. It's a nice description of an advanced technique with good imaging and functional follow-up.
It is an elegant surgical solution. But it is an N of one, so we can't draw broad conclusions on the general applicability or long-term success of this specific implant.
And for our last paper, we have a really complex but fascinating feline case from the same journal. This is from Miki and colleagues at Hokkaido University in Japan. It's a case report on the successful treatment of a left hepatic arteriovenous malformation, or HAVM, in a 5-month-old cat.
These are challenging cases. CT angiography was critical, revealing the HAVM in the left lateral liver lobe and, as expected, multiple acquired portosystemic shunts. The high flow through the malformation was causing portal hypertension and shunting.
The surgical approach was really interesting. First, they resected the entire left hepatic division, because simply ligating the feeding artery wasn't enough to normalize portal pressure. Then, a month later, they went back in and attenuated some of the acquired shunts.
And the result was a complete success. The cat's clinical signs resolved, hepatopedal or normal portal flow was restored, and liver function parameters normalized. The remaining acquired shunts even regressed on their own once the underlying cause was fixed.
This is just a beautiful example of using advanced imaging to plan a complex, staged surgical procedure that leads to a complete cure. The authors state it's the first reported case of feline or canine HAVM, where liver function fully normalized.
A truly excellent report.
That wraps up this week's literature. Please remember that an abstract-only appraisal cannot evaluate full methodologies. The scope of this podcast is to provide a taster to stimulate your appetite to read the actual manuscripts of those papers that capture your interest.
Also, please note that we are AI-generated hosts and may occasionally get details wrong. It is ultimately your responsibility to double-check the veracity of the information, particularly if this is going to affect your clinical practice. Thanks for listening.